thank you for joining us. In today's top story, Israeli forces have killed yet another Palestinian teenager in the occupied West Bank. The Palestinian teen, identified as 15-year-old Milad Muntha Avrai, was shot dead in Al Arub refugee camp north of Al Khalil. Local Palestinian media said he was shot in the back in a raid by Israeli forces. Several other Palestinians were also injured. Israel has stepped up its crackdown on Palestinians following the formation of a far-right cabinet led by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. At least 230 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces since the start of the year. Tens of thousands of Israelis are back on the streets for the 36th consecutive week to protest against the controversial judicial curbs by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's extreme far-right cabinet.
This is the 36th week in a row that we're demonstrating against Netanyahu's attempt to make a coup in Israel and make it a dictatorship. This demonstration is 3 days before the deliberations in the Supreme Court to disable the law that they passed right now.
Mass protests against a judicial overhaul described by protesters as a judicial coup have been ongoing since it was proposed back in January. Israel's Supreme Court began hearing the first in a series of appeals linked to the plan in August. It set off an unprecedented domestic crisis resulting in public unrest, labor strikes and mutiny by some members of the military. Critics say the move removes vital checks on the far-right cabinet's powers. They say they will continue with the protests until they are able to repeal the legislation. The Supreme Court will hear an appeal against the case on September 12. Israeli soldiers have reportedly rioted during a training session for the regime's infantry forces, a sign of rising discontent in the Israeli military. A leaked video shows dozens of soldiers from the Golani Brigade vandalizing property and letting out angry shouts. According to reports, the riots happened on September 4, 2023.
A recent video circulating on social media shows Israeli soldiers of the Army's Golani Brigade rioting during a training session in protest against the far-right Israeli cabinet of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's recent controversial policies. The leaked video shows dozens of soldiers from Israel's Golani Brigade shouting and vandalizing property. According to the reports, several of the protest participants had been disciplined by superiors, resulting in the arrest of several soldiers, including sergeants. The regime's Golani Brigade is mostly made up of elite soldiers specialized in ground warfare. They have carried out armed attacks against Palestinians and have participated in almost all the wars waged by the regime. Ever since the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu announced the proposal for the judicial overhaul, which limits the authority of the national judiciary, the public has held mass demonstrations across Israel. Tens of thousands of military personnel from different sectors of the Israeli army have protested against the decision, including 10,000 reservists from intelligence units and Air Force pilots. They have threatened to no longer show up for duty in protest of Netanyahu's judicial reform efforts. Last month, Israel's Air Force chief suspended a number of senior military reserve forces in the wake of ongoing demonstrations against Netanyahu's judicial overhaul plan. The development came a day after the Israeli Navy suspended two high-ranking reservists after they announced plans to end volunteer reserve duties, in addition to refusing to serve in what they called a dictatorship. Also, cases of suicide within the Israeli occupation forces have grabbed headlines recently, with observers blaming a mental health epidemic among soldiers.
The soaring level of discontent with the far-right cabinet of Benjamin Netanyahu's policies has placed Israel in a dangerous situation. Israeli officials have warned that the regime will be facing an existential threat if the current trend continues. However, is it going to end, or is it just the beginning of Israel's collapse from within?
In July, Israel's chief of staff, General Herzi Halevi, warned that the army's unity has dangerously deteriorated due to the thousands of reservists who have threatened to hold service in protest against the judicial overhaul Israel faces. He also warned that Israel would be in existential peril. Some other Israeli military officials have warned that the reservists' protests are impacting military readiness amid heightened tension between Israel and the axis of resistance, including Hezbollah, Palestinian Islamic Jihad, and Hamas in recent months. Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his supporters have rejected the reservists' protests as a dangerous and unprecedented form of political blackmail by the military, with some equating the protests to attempts at a military coup. Despite the threat of reservists refusing service, Netanyahu's far-right cabinet pushed ahead with the judicial overhaul legislation. The Knesset passed the legislation in a vote in July, despite months of large protests. The legislation struck down the ability of Israel's Supreme Court to veto legislation passed by the Knesset based on the criteria of reasonableness, despite calls from the protest movement to protect what they describe as Israeli democracy. The protesters have not called for the Netanyahu's cabinet to cease.
Search and rescue operations are underway in Morocco to find the survivors of a deadly earthquake that has claimed over 2,000 lives so far. Morocco's Interior Ministry says efforts are in full swing as the army, security services and civil protection are mobilized to provide immediate relief. Local officials say most deaths are in the mountain areas that are hard to reach. The 7.2 magnitude quake struck in Morocco's High Atlas Mountains on Friday. Buildings have collapsed, historic sites damaged, and countless residents rushed from their homes in the country's deadliest tremor since at least 2004. A group of anti-Iran elements have attacked the country's embassy in the French capital, Paris. Spokesperson for the Iranian embassy said the anti-Iran elements burned tires in front of the embassy building and inflicted minor damages to the structure. The spokesperson added that the fire was put out shortly after the presence of police and fire brigades. The official says the situation is now under control and that France's foreign ministry has been notified of the incident. The official noted that an investigation is underway into the attack to find those behind the incident. Iran's president warns about the military presence of extra-regional countries in the Caucasus region amid rising tensions between Armenia and Azerbaijan. Ebrahim Raisi also says any geopolitical change in the Caucasus is Tehran's red line. We have discussed the issue with our guests in our news review program. Let's take a listen.
It's time now for the news review of this bulletin. Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi says the Islamic Republic is seriously opposed to the presence of extra-regional countries in the Caucasus. In a phone call with the Armenian Prime Minister Nikol Pashinyan, Raisi said holding joint drills with foreign forces in the region only further complicates the situation. The remarks came after Armenia announced plans to hold joint war games with the U.S. The Iranian president said any geopolitical change in the Caucasus and the region's borders is Tehran's red line. The Armenian premier, for his part, hailed Iran's stance towards developments in the region. He said that Iran has always played a constructive role in promoting peace and stability in the Caucasus. Tensions have recently risen between Baku and Yerevan, with reports suggesting that Azerbaijan has concentrated its troops around the Nagorno-Karabakh region. Farshi Bagharian is a political analyst who joins us from Karaj in Iran, and Isha Krishnaswamy is a journalist and podcaster who joins us from Madison, Connecticut. Welcome to you both. Farshid, let me first start with you. You know, every time we approach this subject, there's many different dynamics that are involved. Briefly, if you can, tell us what exactly is the point of friction that could lead to a bigger crisis if it's not dealt with in the right way, at least in the Iranian perspective.
I'm afraid of repeating my previous words that this part of the world, I mean the Caucasus, is destined to be conflictful or agitated, full of agitation. And there is turmoil is some part of this destiny of this part of the world. And any new engagement is inevitable. Remember the Nancy Pelosi's traveled over and they promised the Armenian, especially the Armenian administration, that we'll be back over here again. Remember the election race between Mr. Biden and Mr. Trump, and Mr. Trump lost the electoral number, huge number of electoral in the California because of the Armenian, he ignored the Armenian lobby in that part of the United States. And this time, the Republicans are trying to reevaluate the power of the Armenian, lobby. For this reason, they are how can I explain? They are trying to be here, not part of the geopolitical changes. They are trying to be here to changing the administration of the not only the Caucasus, Central Asia, and paving a new road. And this is the presence of the United States in a landlocked country like Armenia is the airborne. For airborne drill is only a part of a big plan to be penetrate to the Central Asia and to be an ambush for the Russian administration and the collective and security collective pact. Yeah.
All right. Well, tell us, Esha, what is going on with the thinking behind Armenia? It seems like obviously they are somewhat discontent with Russia in terms of the protection that they feel Russia is not. Is it protection or attention? Maybe it's both, that Russia is not giving to them. But to go and have joint war games with the U.S.?
Well, let's remember what happened is that in 2018, the U.S. staged a successful color revolution in Armenia. Before, there was a more neutral prime minister, Serge Sargsyan, and now we have Pashinyan, who is... Pashinyan, who is very much a pro-U.S. figure. And, of course, the main thing is that they do not want something like the CTSO uniting as it did in late 2021 when there was a color revolution attempt in Kazakhstan. So the U.S. presence is merely to do what they always do, to kind of divide the region, stop any kind of inter-regional cooperation, anything between Iran and Armenia or Iran and Azerbaijan. And certainly the Belt and Road presence plays a big role. So I think it would be a mistake to think that of the Prime Minister of Armenia as a completely autonomous figure. He is a lot more similar to the president of Ukraine, Zelensky, because of how he came to power, which was through a U.S.-backed color revolution.
Okay, very well. We'll leave it there. Thank you for that, Esha Krishnaswamy, journalist and podcaster there from Madison, Connecticut. Thank you, Farshid Bagheriyan, political analyst from Karachi here in the Islamic Republic. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Syria has denounced the illegal entry of a U.S. delegation into its territory as a flagrant violation of the country's sovereignty. Damascus says the trip of the delegation led by U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State Ethan A. Goldrich amounts to a breach of international law and Security Council resolutions. The Syrian government has decried the delegation's meetings with U.S.-backed militant groups in northern Syria. Damascus says the claim that the visit is aimed at addressing the problems of the residents of Deir al-Zor is a sheer lie and reflects Washington's hypocritical approach. Damascus says the U.S. plunders the wealth of the Syrian people and imposes unjust, illegitimate, and inhumane coercive measures on them. Journalist and commentator Richard Methurst joined us earlier for the comment. He explained the reason behind the U.S. presence in Syria.
The United States' goal in Syria is not only to steal the oil, plundering Syria's wealth. It goes much, much more beyond that. They want to occupy not just everything that is east of the Euphrates River, like Deir ez-Zor and Hasakeh. They want to go all the way down to Al-Tanaf, where they have another illegal presence. The United States really wants to basically cut Syria off from Iraq, Iran, and of course, cut off Hezbollah, cut off Palestine, and really just divide the entire resistance axis. And so in order to keep that plan going, they need to have the Arab tribes and the Kurdish component getting along. And that's not happening right now. It's under risk. And that's why they sent this delegation that you were just speaking of to try and cool things down.
Ukraine has criticized the G20's joint declaration for not condemning Russia for the Moscow-Kiev conflict, saying it was nothing to be proud of. The Ukrainian Foreign Ministry said Kiev's participation in the G20 meeting would have allowed the members to better understand the situation. The ministry, however, thanked Ukraine's allies for doing their part to advance Ukraine's position in the declaration. The reaction came after G20 leaders refrained from directly criticizing Russia over the war in Ukraine. On climate too, the G20 found minimal common ground. There was no commitment to phase out the polluting fuels. Instead, the countries pledged to triple renewable energy sources by 2030. Chinese President Xi Jinping and Russia's Vladimir Putin skipped the annual gathering. With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
We are with you. What about you? Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime is turning the basic needs of Palestinians in Gaza, like food and electricity, into wishes. According to reports, with no electricity amid unprecedented heat wave, Gaza houses have become furnaces. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Truthout noted, it's dark as usual at night in the Gaza Strip as routine power cuts plunge Palestinian homes into darkness. But what has been different during the past weeks is an unprecedentedly stifling summer heat wave. With no electricity, people are getting pushed to their limit. Dina Ahmad, 33, holds her own newborn baby. They both look sticky and sweaty. She puts her son's head in her hand, and the other hand holds a piece of paper, using it as a makeshift fan. The toddler breastfeeds, intermittently due to the extreme heat, before letting out a wail and returning to his mother's breast. Dina's three older sons understand the situation a bit better. Each of them holds up their own makeshift fan and furiously tries to generate some air. They all sit on the floor. It's much cooler than the couches. Sometimes, during particularly hot afternoons at home, Dina sprays the floor with water as they sit on the tiles for hours in wet clothes. Even though their doors and windows are flung wide open, the heat inside their apartment is unbearable, with no fans, air conditioning, or cold water in the fridge. The power is off during the day for over 10 hours. The power schedule shifts in a complicated dance at the Gaza Strip's sole power plant, struggles to ration electricity for the population of over 2 million people. It's normal for people in Gaza to spend half of their days without power now. Over the years, the electricity schedule has gradually decreased the number of hours people get power during the day. But the standard has generally been 8 hours on, 8 hours off. Last winter, the Gaza power crisis forced families to use alternative and hazardous fuel sources to heat their homes in the cold winter months. In some cases, families died due to accidents from improper use of these fuel sources. The summer is different. As demand for power increases during these months, the power company has to ration electricity even further. As Dina's family languishes in their home, they pine over the ability to have just a single fan on. Dina sighs, "Sometimes I feel that the heat can kill. I find myself imagining that my kids will suffocate." If you can't turn on a fan during the hottest part of the year, doesn't that explain a lot about how we live? She asks. A social media campaign went viral during July in Gaza as people reached a breaking point due to the extent of the power crisis. That the social media messages spread following the electricity company's announcement of a new policy requiring customers to replace their old manual electricity meter with a new smart one provided by the company. The new meter would force people to prepay to use the electricity. For many people in Gaza, in the midst of an economic crisis, that requirement is not within reach. Many people are already struggling to pay their bills on time and would rarely have enough money to pay in advance. In a press conference held in the government media office in Gaza in July, the general director of the electricity company, Maher Ayesh, explained the main issue underlying the power crisis. In short, energy needs in residential buildings and their facilities have all been increasing as the population has increased, but available resources have stagnated or, in fact, decreased in Gaza. Ayesh said, "We have been facing a growing inability to supply electricity since 2000, and that inability only increases as our limited resources decrease over time." A single power plant operates in Gaza. The total need for power in Gaza is about 600 megawatts. The available amount is 250. The Zionist regime controls the amount of fuel Gaza receives. While the messages on social media demanded that the power company improve its services, the company claims that the smart meters will benefit people, as they will optimize their use of power and increase it to 50%. Ayesh said, "The company goal is that all the 300,000 customers in Gaza will convert to smart meters by the end of 2024. We have installed 50,000 meters so far. But for families like Dina Ahmad, this won't make a difference either way." She says, "I will break the smart counter if they force us to use it. We will live in caves instead. The power company should help us instead of finding ways to overwhelm us." The Palestinian factions in Gaza have often intervened on behalf of citizens in need. This time, they held a meeting with the power company in Gaza and issued a press release after the meeting. The factions stated that the power crisis requires the efforts of all parties to end it. They also called on Egypt to support Gaza, which used to supply Gaza with power before 2018. The faction's statement also affirmed that people's needs must be put above political considerations and urged the power company in Gaza to consider people's economic conditions, especially poor families, by exempting them from using smart meters. Finally, the statement held the Zionist regime occupation directly responsible for the Gaza power crisis. Weeks after the social media messages and the faction's meeting, people's circumstances have hardly changed, and the idea of using a fan during the day remains a pipe dream. Dina told the Mondo Voices, "When such simple things need a miracle to happen, we see how different we are from the rest of the world," pointing to her sons overwhelmed by the heat, adding, "The Israeli regime siege cut us off from the world, turning our basic needs like food and electricity into wishes."
IRIB English Radio presents
Viewpoints.
The presence of different scholars.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum to you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio Call of Islam page. We welcome to another episode of the program Viewpoints. I'm Ata, the host of this program. Sayyid Mahdi and Sheikh Rouhani are the guest speakers for today's discussion. Sayyid Mahdi, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam, rahmatullah. It's nice to be here.
And Sheikh Rouhani, assalamu alaikum.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
For today's discussion, we want to talk about the era of the imamate of Imam al-Riza alayhi salam. Why Imam al-Riza alayhi salam accepted the invitation of Ma'mun and came from Medina to the city of Khorasan in northeastern part of Persia, Iran today. Sheikh Rouhani, let's start with you, brother. Imam al-Riza alayhi salam was residing in Medina, and now he is invited by the then king of the Muslim empire, Ma'mun, to Khorasan. He accepts and he comes to Khorasan. Why?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Of course, it's a very important question that why did Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam accepted the invitation of Ma'mun to come to Khorasan? First of all, we should know, let's ask this way the question that why did Ma'mun insist on inviting Imam Ridha to Khorasan? Because Ma'mun was a caliph and he was powerful, he was strong enough to do whatever we could in that area. Now the question is that why did he bring Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam to Khorasan? Of course, we cannot say that Ma'mun really wanted to give khilafah, for example, to Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. We cannot say that, for example, Ma'mun loved Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. Out of his love, he invited, Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam to Khorasan. And also, we cannot say that he believed wholeheartedly to the imama of Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. That's why he invited Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam to Khorasan. The point is here that, first of all, Ma'mun was son of a servant, a Persian, I think, Kaniz and servant to Harun al-Rashid. Mm-hmm. Amin was a son of Harun al-Rashid from a pure Arab mother, okay.
So his brother.
There was a kind of racial kind of issue also between Amin and Ma'mun.
Okay.
When Ma'mun killed his brother Amin, who was supposed to be the caliph, then because his mother was not pure Arab, pure Amawi, for example, or Abbasi, that's why the Arabs did not accept Ma'mun as a caliph, mm-hmm. because of
as
his mother.
As a pure Arab king.
Because of his mother.
Yes.
So among the Arabs, he was not accepted. Rather, Amin was accepted mostly by the Arabs, or particularly by the Abbasids. So he had problem with the society, with the Arab society. So that's why he established his government in Khorasan. In Khorasan, again, he had another problem. Mm-hmm. The problem was that the people of Khorasan stood against Amawids. Because Abu Muslim Khorasani waged a war against Amawids, and he toppled down the Khilafah of Amawids by the help of the people of Khorasan. Mm-hmm. So the main objective of the people of Khorasan was this, that to give Khilafah to Ahlul Bayt. Uh-huh. This was the main objective of this Qiyam or revolt against Amawids. But later the people of Khorasan understood that they were deceived by the Abbasids.
Okay.
Abbasids promised them that we will give Khilafah to the Ahlul Bayt, but they didn't do that. Uh-huh. So they understood that. Now Ma'mun feared a lot from the people of Khorasan. Uh-huh. The people of Khorasan, if they defeated, for example, Amawids by that kind of powerful establishment and Khilafah, so they were easily able to do each and everything against Ma'mun. That is why he feared a lot the people of Khorasan, because he deceived them.
Yes.
Then, among the Arabs, he was not that much popular, that much welcomed by the Arabs.
Yes.
So he had lots of problems. That's why, actually, we can see that he was forced and pressurized by the people of Khorasan to bring Imam Ridha alayhi wasalam to Ma'ruf and give Khilafah to him, mm-hmm. as you promised us.
Okay.
That's why we revolt against Amawids. That's why we stopped Amawids from Khilafah to give Khilafah to what? To the pure Ahlul Bayt alayhi salatu wasalam. Why did you deceive us?
Yes.
You know? Why yes. Harun al-Rashid and Ma'mun and the other Abbasid caliphs deceived us? So that's why, since Ma'mun was not supported by the Arabs very powerfully, while Harun al-Rashid was not such.
Yes.
His father. And then the people of Khorasan also was so much, let's say what we can say, skeptical.
Yes.
Yeah.
Suspicious.
Yes. On Ma'mun.
Yes.
That's why Ma'mun invited Imam Ridha. He did not love Imam Ridha. He did not believe in Imam of Imam Ridha. He did not actually really want to give Khilafah because he killed his brother because of the Khilafah. How can he give Khilafah to Imam Ridha?
Mm-hmm.
You know? Of course, it was because of the fear of the people of Khorasan that they will do what they did with Amawids,
yes.
with me, with the Abbasids.
Mm-hmm.
So that's why he invited Imam Ridha.
In order to silence them,
yeah.
you know, he invited
But Imam Ridha did know that Ma'mun want to deceive again the people. And that's why Imam Ridha did not willingly go to Khorasan.
Yes.
He was also forced to leave Medina. Imam Ridha really liked to stay in Medina,
yes.
the Medina of his Jad, his grandfather. But unfortunately, Ma'mun forced him to
That's
come
right.
to Khorasan. Yes.
Okay. And now Imam Ridha alayhi salam is known as the vicegerent or the valiat of Ma'mun over there. This means that after Ma'mun, Imam Ridha will be the then, for example, king or let's say ruler or the first man, the head of the Muslim Ummah at that time. Sayyid Nawwi. But Ma'mun martyrs Imam al-Raza alayhi salam. Why?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. I want to kind of start with taking another angle of the idea of why Imam Ridha, why Ma'mun al-Rashid would have offered Imam Ridha alayhi salam, you know, this position of waliyahad. So this other aspect here, right, as Sheikh Rouhani, you know, very well said that Ma'mun al-Rashid was looking for legitimacy for his government. So Imam Ridha alayhi salam was the perfect candidate that would bring him this legitimacy from all different aspects. So one was that, you know, Imam Ridha alayhi salam was from Bani Hashim, he was from Quraysh, he was Arab.
Yes.
On one side. On the second side, because of the love that the people of the area of Khorasan, so Khorasan in the present day is, you know, is a small province in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In that day, it was a huge province. It included Afghanistan, probably northern Pakistan, much of Iran was a part, you know, Turkmenistan,
yes.
Uzbekistan. This was all considered Kazakhstan, these areas were all considered to be Khorasan. It was a huge, huge
yes.
province and very wealthy, very prosperous. So the people in this whole area, you know, they had a tendency to have the love of the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam.
Mm-hmm.
So on one side, he gains the legitimacy of the Arabs. On the other side, he gains the legitimacy of the Shia and the people who support the Ahlul Bayt, alayhimus salam. And then he's also able to control a lot of the Alawi uprisings which were occurring. So you see, for example, Zayd bin Ali had his uprising, Nafs-e Zakiya, right? And these kind of different individuals throughout these after the Umayyads and in between the Abbasis, you know, who were doing uprisings. So these were also under control. But one thing that I want to add, which is very fundamental, is that by this time, so you have Imam Ali alayhi salam, then you have Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Imam Sajjad, Imam Baqir, Imam Jafar al-Sadiq, Imam Qasim alayhi salam, peace and blessings upon them all. You have seven divinely appointed imams, which have been teaching the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, the pure teachings of the Messenger, the pure teachings of the Quran. So they have a very large following, right?
Yes.
And one of the things that every single one of these imams have claimed is that they are divinely appointed.
Mm-hmm.
They are the true wali, whether it is in the spiritual field or the political field.
Mm-hmm.
So politically, Imam Ridha alayhi salam himself also poses a threat to Ma'mun al-Rashid and the Abbasids, being the wali of Allah, being the political, spiritual authority. So he kind of does all of these things, brings Imam Ridha alayhi salam into the fold. What's interesting, I think Sheikh Rouhani also brought it up, was this idea that Imam Ridha alayhi salam, first he totally rejected the offer. and in public, right? So in this great gathering where Mahmoud al-Rashid says, I will make you the waliahed, I will hand you the khilafa, the political governmental authority, Imam Rida alayhi salam says, I don't want it. Mm-hmm. Then he says, no, I'm offering you this wali ahad. And again, second time, Imam Rida alayhi salam rejects it to the point where one of the viziers in the court of Mamun al-Rashid, he says, I've never seen such a pathetic khilafa before, where the one who has the khilafa doesn't want it and is giving it to another person. And the one that he is giving it to says, I don't want this khilafa. Okay. Right? Imam Rida alayhi salam rejects it. Finally, you know, in very subtle terms, Mamun al-Rashid says that, you know, if you don't take this khilafa, the wali ahad, you know, I will kill you. And at this point, Imam Rida says that if I'm going to accept the wali ahad, this vice regency position, then I will not be involved in any of the governmental affairs. Right? So this is a huge statement on behalf of Imam Rida alayhi salam.
Hmm. That's all right. So there were some conditions put by Imam Rida alayhi salam.
Well, the main condition was that I'm not going to be involved in any of the political matters. So it shows you that he does not consider the government of the Abbasids to be legitimate, right?
Yes, yes.
You don't have a legitimate government, so why would I be involved in any of your affairs? One last thing. I'm sorry I spoke more than I should have. These corrupted kings, you know, whether it was Bani Umayyah or it was Bani Abbas, after Imam Hussein alayhi salam, they realized that killing these people openly was incredibly dangerous. Mm-hmm. So they never made that mistake again. So this is just another way of trying to, quote unquote, kill Imam Rida alayhi salam. One of the things that happened after they gave him the position of Wali Ahad is Imam Rida alayhi salam's own supporters said, you know, what are you doing? How can you be, you know, joined with Ma'mun, these individuals who are the killers of the Shia? They're the killers of your forefathers. So this was a manner of character assassination of Imam Rida alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
He was poisoned. And the bruises on the hands of Imam al-Rida alayhi salam showed that he was, we can say, poisoned on that time. So as you said, that's right. It was not like assassination or killing or through sword or something like that. They tried, but they were not successful. And finally, unfortunately, he was poisoned. Even Imam al-Rida alayhi salam selected the masjid and the mosque as his residing place, isn't
yes,
it, Sheikh
Rouhani,
on that time, in order to show that he has no connection with the palaces of the king of that time.
He was just always worshipping Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
So during all these years in Khorasan,
performing the prayers,
he has been the source of becomes a benefit for spiritually, up to an extent that even the closest family members of the Ma'amun believed in Imam al-Rida alayhi salam. They referred to him. One important prayer for raining happened during the another sign of the becomes a miraculous action of Imam al-Rida alayhi salam on that time. So let's talk a little bit about these aspects of the life.
Of course. You know, when Imam Rida alayhi wasalam was brought to Marv, of course, some of the Abbasids, as you rightly mentioned, they firstly, they did not believe in that kind of spiritual, which you can say, position or status of Imam Rida alayhi wasalam in the hearts of the people. But when Imam Rida, for example, arrived at the city of Nishabur or Nisabur, which is mentioned in the historical sources, they saw that numberless people gathered for Imam Rida. They was waiting for Imam Rida alayhi salatu wasalam. And then they asked Imam Rida alayhi salatu wasalam to talk, to speak for them, to present a speech or lecture to the people and to narrate some hadith from his forefathers, because the most pure and trustable, let's say, chain of transmitters of a hadith is the holy imams and the infallible imams. That's why all the scholars, the people, the narrators all asked Imam Rida alayhi salam to tell us some hadith of the Holy Prophet, your forefather. So he mentioned that hadith, Silsilat al-Dhahab, which is with the golden chain, is mentioned in our narration as this very nice hadith. Yeah, he mentioned many points. One of them is really significant that he said that wilayatu Ali ibn Abi Talib alayhi salatu wassalam. Hisni. So then he finally added this point So yeah, this phrase that Imam Ridha said, it was clearly mentioned to the people that if you follow me, then of course you'll be the right path.
If you want to take refuge in the strongholds, you have to refer to me. That's right.
Of course. So then the people understood the reality and the truth from this hadith of Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam, because very smartly we can say Imam Ridha mentioned this point to the city of Nishabur. And then when he came to the Marv, again the Ma'mun and the Abbasids saw thousands of people gathered in the city of Marv to embrace, to welcome Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. Whenever Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam stood for the prayer, they said, oh, lots of people. Stand behind Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam and say the prayers. When Imam Ridha went to do for the Eid prayer, lots of people gathered from the different villages, different provinces from all across Khorasan. And then Ma'mun came and told Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam that he shouldn't, what we can say, perform the khutbah. Because of what Imam Ridha said, what? He said, because we are, let's say, what we can say, worried about your security, safety, because the people might kill you. So it was like games they played, And then Imam Ridha said, okay, no problem. You lead the prayer and you say the khutbah. And then in another day when he prayed for rain, of course, it was raining after immediately after the prayer of Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam. Then, of course, all the people knew that he is the most knowledgeable person, because in those debates, discussions that he had with non-Muslims, Muslims, Sunnis,
answering them
Christians,
from their own books,
Zoroastrians, Jews, Lords, Sabi'ins, so all of them are reported, then the people understood that, yes, he is the most scholarly figure in the Ahlul Bayt alayhim salatu wasalam, and he is the most pious, the most pure, the most, we can say, abid and zahid, what we can say, the most, the closest person to Almighty Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, because when he pray for rain, then immediately raining. So there's all these things show that Imam Ridha alayhi salatu wasalam was the only legitimate imam.
That's right.
The only true guide for the ummah. That's why Ma'mun again feared a lot that his game did not work. Yeah, the people understood the reality, though the people already understood. But unfortunately, of course, finally he decided to poison the holy imam.
That's all right. Thank you very much, Sheikh Rouhani and Sayyid Mahdi, for a nice elaboration regarding Imam Ridha alayhi salam, the reason for his coming from Medina to Khorasan, and why Ma'mun martyred Imam Ridha alayhi salam. It was very kind of you. And thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to us. For more information, visit our website at parstoday.ir, Call of Islam page. To another episode, God bless you all. Fi amanallah.
I know that you could easily take away everything you've given me, and I try to remember not to take anything from.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, for listening to this episode of Viewpoints. Please don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.ir. Until next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Allah, ya Allah, guide me all the way to your Jannah. Ya Allah, don't let me go astray, cause I need you by my side. I wish to be
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
According to U.S. lawmakers who were present during a recent closed-door questioning, Devon Archer, former business associate and longtime friend of Hunter Biden, testified that the president's son used the Biden brand to his advantage while working for Ukrainian energy company Burisma. We take a look at some of the world media and press's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The Fox News Channel has covered this story and tells us more. U.S. House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer said Devon Archer, a former business associate and longtime friend of Hunter Biden, confirmed in his appearance on Monday, 31st of July, that President Joe Biden lied to the American people when he said he had no knowledge about his son's business dealings and was not involved. James Comer's comments came after Devon Archer sat for hours before the House Oversight Committee in a closed-door hearing on Monday. Devon Archer said that Hunter Biden put his father, then Vice President Joe Biden, on speakerphone while meeting with business partners at least 20 times. Devon Archer described how Joe Biden was put on the phone to sell the brand. The House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer said, "Joe Biden was the brand that his son sold around the world to enrich the Biden family." Comer added, "When Joe Biden was Vice President of the United States, he joined Hunter Biden's dinners with his foreign business associates in person or by speakerphone over 20 times." James Comer continued by saying, "When Burisma's owner was facing pressure from the Ukrainian prosecutor investigating the company for corruption, Devon Archer testified that Burisma executives asked Hunter Biden to call Washington, D.C. after a Burisma board meeting in Dubai. He asked, 'Why did Joe Biden lie to the American people about his family's business dealings and his involvement?' He added, 'It begs the question what else he's hiding from the American people.'" The House Oversight Committee Chairman James Comer said, "The House Committee on Oversight and Accountability will continue to follow the Biden's money trail and interview witnesses to determine whether foreign actors targeted the Bidens. President Biden is compromised and corrupt, and our national security is threatened." Devon Archer's attorney, Matthew Schwartz, the managing partner of Boies Schiller Flexner LLP, released a statement on Monday, 31st of July, following his client's testimony. Matthew Schwartz said, "We're aware that all sides are claiming victory following Devon Archer's voluntary interview today. But all Devon Archer did was exactly what he said he would do: show up and answer the questions put to him honestly and completely." Matthew Schwartz added, "Devon Archer shared the truth with the committee, and we will leave to them and others to decide what to do with it." James Comer detailed the key takeaways from Devon Archer's hour-long testimony on Monday. Devon Archer, who served on the board of Ukrainian natural gas firm Burisma Holdings alongside Hunter Biden beginning in 2014, told lawmakers that the value of adding Hunter Biden to the board, executive board, was to build the company's brand. According to James Comer, Devon Archer confirmed that then Vice President Joe Biden was the brand. Archer also testified that Burisma would have gone out of business if the brand had not been attached to it. According to James Comer's office, Devon Archer said he believed that Hunter Biden being on the board and the Biden brand contributed to Burisma's longevity, and suggested that people would have been intimidated to mess with Burisma legally because of the Biden brand. Meanwhile, Devon Archer testified about an interaction in December of 2015 involving Burisma's chief executive officer, Mykola Zlochevsky, and Vadim Pozharsky, an executive at the firm. Devon Archer said Zlochevsky and Pozharsky placed constant pressure on Hunter Biden to get help from Washington, D.C., in getting Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin ousted. Viktor Shokin was investigating Burisma for corruption. According to the source, Devon Archer testified that on 4th of December 2015, Hunter Biden, Zlochevsky and Pozharsky called Washington, D.C. to discuss the matter. Devon Archer testified that Biden, Zlochevsky and Pozharsky stepped away to make the call. It is unclear if Hunter Biden and the Burisma executive spoke directly to Joe Biden on that matter, though at the time Joe Biden was in charge of U.S.-Ukraine policy for the Barack Obama administration. A source confirmed that Devon Archer testified that just days later, on 9th of December 2015, Joe Biden traveled to Ukraine and made a speech. Biden, during that speech, said the government needed to fix the Ukrainian prosecutor's office. House Judiciary Committee Chairman Jim Jordan told Fox News Channel, "This is the most revealing aspect of Devon Archer's testimony and may be the most important in our entire investigation so far." National broadcaster NBC News has also covered the same story. The testimony of Devon Archer, a longtime friend of Hunter Biden, comes after U.S. media first reported on an unclassified version of an FBI-generated FD-1023 form, which contained charges that Joe Biden and Hunter Biden coerced Zlochevsky to pay them millions of dollars in exchange for their help in getting Ukrainian prosecutor Viktor Shokin fired. Biden has acknowledged that when he was vice president, he successfully pressured Ukraine to fire prosecutor Viktor Shokin. At the time, Viktor Shokin was investigating Burisma Holdings, and at the time, Hunter Biden had a highly lucrative role on the board, on the executive board, receiving thousands of dollars per month. The then vice president threatened to withhold $1 billion of critical U.S. aid if Viktor Shokin was not fired. Biden allies maintained that then-Vice President pushed for Shokin's firing due to concerns the Ukrainian prosecutor went easy on corruption, and say that his firing at the time was the policy position of the U.S. and international community. James Comer said that the December 2015 phone call from Biden, Zlochevsky and Pozharsky to Washington, D.C., raises concerns that Hunter Biden was in violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Federal prosecutors, during Hunter Biden's recent court appearance, in which he pled not guilty to federal tax crimes and a felony gun charge, hinted that the Justice Department is investigating Hunter Biden for potential violations of the Foreign Agents Registration Act. Meanwhile, James Comer said that Devon Archer testified that Hunter Biden put then-Vice President Joe Biden under speakerphone during the business meetings over 20 times, despite the White House and Joe Biden himself denying ever having been in business with Hunter Biden or having ever been involved. According to Devon Archer, the phone calls and meetings included a dinner in Paris with a French energy company and in China with Jonathan Lee, the chief executive officer of BHR Partners, a joint venture between Rosemont Seneca and Chinese investment firm Bohai Capital. BHR Partners is a Beijing-backed private equity firm controlled by Bank of China Limited. Devon Archer also testified that then-Vice President Joe Biden had coffee with Jonathan Lee, the chief executive officer of BHR in Beijing. Then Vice President Joe Biden even wrote a letter of recommendation for college for Jonathan Lee's daughter. Moreover, Devon Archer testified that in the spring of 2014, then-Vice President Biden attended a business dinner with his son, Hunter Biden, and his associates at Cafe Milano in Washington, D.C. Elena Baturina, a Russian oligarch who is the widow of the former mayor of Moscow, attended that dinner. James Comer's office said, notably, the Biden administration's public sanctions list for Russian oligarchs does not contain Baturina. The White House reacted to Devon Archer's testimony on Monday, 31st of July. White House spokesperson Ian Sam said, it appears that the House Republicans' own much-hyped witness today testified that he never heard of President Biden discussing business with his son or his son's associates or doing anything wrong. House Republicans keep promising bombshell evidence to support their ridiculous attacks against the president, but time and time, they keep failing to produce any.
Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. This is IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Your headlines for this hour: Israeli forces fatally shoot a 15-year-old Palestinian boy in the occupied West Bank. Search and rescue operation is underway in Morocco, where the deadliest earthquake in decades has already claimed over 2,000 lives. And Iran's president warns about the military presence of extra-regional countries in the Caucasus amid rising tension between Armenia and Azerbaijan.